Go for it. Okay, great. Well, thanks everyone for coming to this Unplug session. For people that are not familiar with the format, this is a little different than most talks. Basically, the way this session works is it's very much driven by you. So typically what I do is I have a text editor open. I'm going to ask everyone to suggest questions or topics they want me to cover. I'm going to write down as many of them as you have, and then I create a talk on the fly based on the questions that you ask. So I can cover pretty much anything in the world that you want me to talk about. Software works best, but I've had people ask about sports, about the weather.
Коллеги, вы можете задать любой вопрос на русском, либо на английском, кто может. И Скотт.
You can ask questions in Russian or in English. Раз, два, три. Раз, два, три. Я на пятом канале, английский.
You mentioned slightly about the updates of the application. For instance, I have a web application. I'm rolling out new update. You showed us a couple of for a couple of seconds, kind of good, cool experience when you can just upload new bits and then you just switch kind of the routes. But the problem always with such things, well, sometimes I'm having in my environment is the SQL database. So how does all this works? Because, you know, it's kind of easy to put files, your DLLs in a separate directory, and then you can just switch the root of the Internet Information Server. But when do you kind of update the SQL scripts? And for instance, if my web application takes like 15 seconds to boot up, like, you know, it's pre-caching some data or whatever, how it's going to process the requests which were in the system just before the update and during this period of time? How does it work? Okay.
Sounds good.
Because, you know, sometimes the DLLs may not work with the SQL code, you know, at some period of time. Okay?
Well, sounds good. We'll add those to the list.
So I also have a couple questions. I'd like to hear your opinion on what will be the next steps for Windows development, especially I'd like to hear about Metro applications development, and especially I'd like to hear about Metro games. I mean, currently there are not so much games in the App Store, and how this gap will be covered. And also, is there is any rumors or information about developing some top title games like desktop games, Civilization, I don't know, Crysis or something like that, but in Metro format, because probably tablets with Intel processors and with some relatively good integrated graphics could launch these games. Right, so it would be great to have great gaming experience on such mm-hmm. platforms. And also, I'd like to know if there is any plans to reduce the gap in development of games on Xbox, for example, on future generation of Xbox, and applications for PCs. I mean, the Xbox dashboard is already in Metro style, was designed like Metro style, and it would be, I don't know, great to develop the application for Xbox and automatically get it working on the PC, so to not waste time on porting.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good. Those two.
So, hello. I have a question about Azure. So, what is the best way to provide high SLA for our services? Because in different sources we have different recommendations, like use two instances, but Mark on previous session said that three instances will be reliable in most cases. And what is the your recommendations about handling issues with partial unavailability of the instances or SQL or Azure services? So while developing the Azure service, we faced a lot of issues related to the unavailability of Azure services. One more question is unrelated to Azure and about maybe general strategy of Microsoft. So most companies try to create user product right now, but as I can see from my perspective, Microsoft tries to create platform and sell the platform, not the product. But the customers maybe want the product more. What do you think about that?
Sure. Okay.
Well, hello. I have two questions. One is about app update. I have .NET application, which is essentially a service. It's not visual. What is the best practice for this application to self-update? Because the main problem is to handle crashes. If self-update application crashes, it stops to operate and to update. Well, and the next question is, recently I have faced Windows 8, and I faced with strange behavior. When I map drive from command line, this drive mapping is not visible under Explorer, and vice versa. Why is it so? What was the reason to design this behavior in such a way?
Sorry, can you explain, what was the thing that wasn't available?
Sorry?
For your second question, you mentioned why was the behavior that way, but I wasn't sure what the beginning part of that was.
Please repeat.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, for your second question, I didn't catch, was WebDrive, or I didn't quite understand the...
No. Open Explorer, and then issue map network drive command. Well, I enter UNC pass, and drive is mapped. Then I go to the command line, type, trying to CD with this letter, and it fails. There are no map, for example, Z, from command line, and vice versa. When I issue command match, use, and so on, there is a letter in command line, but there are no letter in internet, Windows Explorer.
Okay. Don't find out the entire answer to that, but I'll try.
Yeah, hi, Scott. My first question is, you mentioned earlier in your previous session the kind of building blocks for the Windows Azure. So one of the blocks was the big data block. So what do you provide with for big data in Windows Azure? So and one more question is about private clouds. So what are the practices? Are companies building their own like clouds? What is the kind of trend in the thanks? Thank you.
Hello, Scott. I have a couple of questions. One is regarding the DNS in the infrastructure service. As far as I suppose everyone knows, the DNS can be configured only when you create the virtual network. And so what is the best practice to create a redundancy Active Directory domain? When I create a domain controller, I cannot know its IP address before it's created, so I cannot put it in DNS, and DHCP doesn't list this as a DNS server for the virtual machines in EAS. So when I switch off my primary domain controller in the local network, the virtual machines cannot reach the main at all. And the next questions, maybe you can speak a couple of words regarding the Active Directory Federation services and how to merge it with Office 365, and if it's possible at all. Thank you.
Great. Вопрос на русском.
Our last question in Russian. The application, we don't want to take scripts from the network and don't launch them under Windows 8. In other words, where is the allowability? What can be done and what cannot be done so that we could do a very rich application so that users would write some scripts and the client would execute them on Windows 8? So scripts would be in the network, but they would be executed in Windows 8. And this limitation prohibits that. Maybe there is some kind of a threshold and possibility to do that.
Today it's not possible to run scripts from share on network from a Windows 8 application. So the question is, where is the red line? What is possible and what is not possible for Windows 8 application, and why its line is there?
Okay.
Yeah, another couple of questions. So now we have SQL Server 2012, and now they have cool feature. Unfortunately, it's only under enterprise license, but you know, it's called always on. So you can have several active nodes, and you can read from them. So you can potentially have a kind of really powerful application. So you can, you know, have lots of web kind of nodes which can work with it. And the opposite, you have SQL Azure. So if we don't take into account all those limitations, which now, let's hope, not only now SQL Azure has, so what's the kind of your, you know, suggestions, where should we invest, you know, when we need to have such a, you know, large applications and stuff like that. And the last question, why do, you know, maybe it's not to you, but why do we really need three client operating systems? I mean, Windows 8, Windows Phone, and Windows RT. Why can't, you know, either like just Windows Phone for those tablets and slates? Because, you know, in my vision, it's, you know, the border between them is kind of blur. I mean, between Windows RT and Windows Phone, because, you know, they say that they share a lot of code, you know, the core is kind of the same and stuff like that. Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Hey, Scott, once again. I'll try to put it short. The question is, well, I guess I will not be able to put it short. So you were talking about the scales of websites which are hosting on Business Asia. And what if I have a small website and my competitors decided to organize a DDoS attack? Would I be able to resist this attack? And would I have to pay, spend a lot of money to scale out my website to resist it?
Okay.
Scott, we have some questions from Twitter.
Okay.
And online audience. So first question is, tell more about Big Compute initiative you announced a couple of days ago. Big Compute about a new offering in Windows Azure, about new large instances for Windows Azure.
Okay.
It's a huge announce about Big Compute and about the Linpack tests, about benchmark of Linpack tests.
Okay.
And okay. And another question is, when we will see Android support in mobile services?
Oh, sorry, what was the last one there?
Android support in mobile services.
Oh, Android support in mobile services. Okay.
Yes. And last question is. Have you planned to extend data centers of Windows Azure, and will the Microsoft will come to Russia with data center? Okay.
One more. Okay, we'll do one more.
A small question: how we can set up a connection between local machine and VPN connection between local machine and virtual machine in Windows Azure.
Okay.
And last question, please.
Hello again. You already answered a couple of my questions.
Sure.
So I have another one. What is about the Azure scalability? Because how can I measure that my application is running well? What if 10 more users will just leave that the application stop responding? Maybe I can analyze something. Are there any ways just playing with size of instance and with the number of instances and running stress testing or something? Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Is that enough?
Sure, we're actually out of time, so we're
going
to go.
Okay, great.
I think this is a good set of questions. So let's see. I'm going to move these around a little bit so that we group them logically. So we'll put the client ones together. Okay, so there's a couple of client ones there. Let's move the Azure ones together. There were, I don't know if that's a client one. Move that one there. Sort of office ones, that's a client one. Okay. Cool, and that way we can try to hit all the Azure ones in one place, and then we'll move on there. Okay. Let me see, where's the scaling one? Almost close to this one. Okay, so a couple quick ones. In terms of Android support for Windows Azure mobile services, someone was asking about the strategy and the plan for there. So today, this morning in the keynote, I showed how to use mobile services from a Windows 8 app. We also support the ability to create mobile services and consume it from Windows Phone 8. and iOS. Android support is next on our list, and will probably be coming out, I think, in the January timeframe. You can use mobile services from Android today if you write to the REST APIs directly, but our plan, probably in the next couple weeks, will be to have a Java API that you can use from within Android apps directly, and provides a nice clean abstraction for it. We're also planning to add support for HTML5 apps, to talk to mobile services as well. And that will take advantage of some of the core support in modern browsers. And that will also enable you to build pure HTML apps that you can call from any mobile device that supports that standard. So, coming soon. Question then was on protection from distributed denial of service attacks with websites. One thing that we do provide with Azure today is network monitoring. So our operations team looks for denial of service attacks, and if and when we detect that one is happening, we take measures to try to help protect you at the network level. So I think the question was, you know, if you have like a personal website, in general, it's rare to have a personal website be hit by a denial of service attack. I think a distributed denial of service attack, especially. I think if we detected that, we would try to insulate you at the network level if we could. From a pricing perspective, we don't charge you more based on the number of requests you get. I think your concern was, would it end up costing you a fortune? We don't charge for network bandwidth into the data center. We only charge for network bandwidth out. If your personal website was hit by a million clients, and it was on the shared mode, you know, either you hit your cap, in which case it would turn off, or, if that happened, I think we would, even if it did return a lot of data, I think we'd end up forgiving you and you wouldn't have to pay anything. But generally, we try to keep an eye out for those types of attacks and provide protection against them. Question about how to measure the capacity of your Azure app. This is a good question. And it's hard to provide a simple answer. You know, in general, doing real-world stress testing is the best way to really understand how well your app will perform. And generally, with capacity, there's two measures you want to look at. One is how many requests or users can you handle, and then also what is the response time for which you can handle. And so when you're doing capacity testing, you really want to look at both metrics, because some apps are very good at handling lots of requests, but they might take longer to return than is deemed acceptable. One strategy to look at if you're building a very large app is also to partition the app up into kind of smaller logical units. And so we see this with some of our biggest customers today, where they might deploy multiple instances of the app and then use a CDN or front-end traffic manager to partition traffic to the different instances. And that provides you the ability where you can test each instance separately to see what the capacity requirements are. And as your usage grows, you simply spin up a new instance. And so you could end up having, say, 100 servers for each instance. And you can do your load and capacity testing, assuming this many users maps to this many instances. But really, testing in real world is probably the best and only way to really know how the overall system scales. The other thing I would mention about capacity testing is a place to focus the most attention on would be at the database layer or the data layer. The nice thing about the Azure compute model is that you can scale it out, you know, almost to infinity in terms of the number of servers that are handling your web and middle tier. But your database can be a single point of contention and end up being the limiting factor of your scale. If you think that you're going to have a lot of data or a lot of users, one thing to kind of design up front is to what's called a sharding strategy around your data access. And what that means is instead of having one giant database, you instead have multiple databases and you partition the data across them. And so, you know, a simple pattern could be customers whose last name start with G go to server one. Customers whose last name starts with H goes to server two. You probably want something more complicated than that as your partitioning strategy, but it gives you a sense of kind of how you can split it up. And the benefit there is as you get more data and as you get more load, you can spread it out over more servers in the back end and not get a single point of conflict. The other thing I'd really recommend for high scale is to look at our new dedicated cache. It gives you kind of, I think it averages about 1.1 millisecond response time. And it allows you to remove a whole bunch of load off of your single point of conflict at the database layer. Another interesting design question is how to provide a higher level SLA on Azure. And this is something that is very important to think about as you're building large distributed apps. You know, one algorithm to look at as you're thinking about SLAs is if something has a 99.9% SLA for the month, the amount of downtime, you know, is equal to 0.1% times 720. If you're using a 99.9% SLA service with another service that also has 99.9% SLA, your amount of downtime is not equal to this. It's equal to 2 times that. And so as you add dependencies on your application, if there's single points of failure, the amount of downtime you'll have each month will continue to increase. And so often I will hear from people that say, I'm using this and this and this. Why am I seeing more downtime? Why am I not meeting a 99.9% SLA? And that's if you have 3 separate services that each have that SLA, your collective SLA will be lower. the way to avoid that is to design your application so that you don't have a dependency on a single instance SLA. Meaning if you have a storage account, you don't have one, you have two, and you design your app so that you can use either one of them in the event of a failure. Or an even better strategy, if you can, is to run two versions of your app in two separate regions or in two separate data centers. And that way, if there's any failure at the data center level or in a service within it, you can automatically switch to the other version of the app. Running multiple instances of the app simultaneously is fairly easy today with Azure from a compute perspective, because the code you write, you can just point and run in multiple data centers. Where the strategy gets harder is at the data layer. And so if you have customers that write data in multiple places, how do you handle automatically failing over depending on which place is available or not? There are some frameworks that we support today that can help with that. One that's worth looking at is called the CQRS, which can help you get eventual consistency across multiple locations. We also support something called Data Sync with SQL Azure that enables you to keep data in sync across multiple databases. And you'll see us add more features in the future, especially at the storage and data layer levels, where we will be able to provide kind of better support for that. Other techniques you can use within your application is to provide a kind of partial degraded experience when a service that you have a dependency on fails. And if you use popular, websites or services on the internet, you're probably used to seeing something like that. For example, when Twitter is overloaded, they turn off the ability to search. Or they'll show you only the last 20 tweets and not show you anything beyond that. And that's an example of the system kind of providing a degraded experience that doesn't turn customers away and still is able to provide base functionality. So if you want a mission-critical style solution, some of these are design decisions you want to make up front. And if you do that, you can provide a high SLA service to your customers. But it is something you need to consciously think about. And this is really true for any cloud or internet scale service. It's not specific to Windows Azure. And it's something to think about. There's a question about compute announcements we made last week. I have to confess, I'm not exactly sure what we announced.
Scott, let me explain this question.
I know what we're doing, and so I'm dangerous because I actually know the compute announcements.
The announcement was on official Windows Azure blog about future plans about future plans of Windows Azure team to bring for developers two new instances with 8 cores and 80 gigabytes of RAM and 60 cores and 16 cores and 160 gigabytes of RAM for big compute tasks. So this is the nonsense. So if you can add something to, please.
We have many new compute types that will be coming out. So I can't provide specifics on exactly what we announced, just in case I end up announcing something new that we haven't announced yet. But I think the announcement, based on what you described, is in relation to some of our high-performance computing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And so there are some new compute types that will be available, where if you need large cores or large amounts of memory, or very, very fast, low latency networking, you'll be able to build and deploy apps on top of those. And those will be standard compute types that you can select when you build and deploy your applications. And in general, you'll see many more hardware options come out in the months ahead. And at a high level, our goal is to provide a really flexible environment that you can run any workload on. Someone asked a question about the data center strategy for Windows Azure, and I think specifically what other parts of the world that we're going to open up into. I mentioned earlier, I think in my overview talk, we are in 8 regions around the world today, 4 in North America, 2 in Asia, 2 in Europe. You're going to see us expand our global footprint more in the year ahead. And so we are kind of expanding what we call regions pretty aggressively. We've announced two new regions that we're going to be adding to China. And we also have a region in Hong Kong. Those are the only two that we've already announced, but we are working and engaging on several other locations as well. And so, expect to see more announcements in the months ahead as we make those available. There's a question around how to set up a connection between a local server and Windows Azure. With VPN. Basically, there's two approaches you can do. One is to use a virtual private network, and we make it now possible to fairly easily set up a virtual private network that can connect both your infrastructure as a service VMs as well as your cloud services to an on-premise network. And basically what you do is you create a virtual network inside Windows Azure, join your machines to it, and then you can link it to a VPN gateway running on your on-premise environment. One of the things we've tried to do is to make sure that we work with popular VPN solutions. So we don't require any software on your local network. Instead, we actually work with common hardware solutions. And today we support both Cisco as well as Juniper routers. And so what you can do is go into the Windows Azure portal, define your network, and then you can download from the portal a appropriate Cisco or Juniper script that you can then run against your router. And the script includes the certificates to connect to Azure. And once you do that, the two networks are joined. And a benefit with that approach is that if your enterprise or your organization already has that hardware, you can just give the script to your network administrator and you're active within 2 or 3 minutes. We are also planning to add support for software-based virtual networks, private network solutions in the future. as well as other hardware-based devices. Question was, I mentioned big data as one of the application building blocks in my overview talk. And there's a question of what specifically is in that big data bucket. One of the features you're going to, in general, you'll see more and more capability show up with big data. One of the capabilities that we've announced, and it's currently in private preview mode, is a Hadoop-based service we call HD Insight. This will enable you inside our portal to stand up a Hadoop cluster that you can then run MapReduce jobs against any form of data within Azure. And we think we'll provide a really great experience for doing data mining as well as MapReduce workloads. We also support SQL reporting services. And so if you'd like to run a more traditional BI workload against data inside SQL, you can also do that. A couple questions around app updates. The first one here was about how to handle app updates with a SQL database. Generally, handling schema changes inside application change with applications can be challenging. There's a couple of strategies that you can take. One that I typically recommend is if you want to make sure there's no application downtime, to use a strategy where you incrementally update the database with your new columns first, then update the code to use them. Yeah, and that's typically is kind of from a backward compatibility mode perspective, make non-destructive changes, roll out app updates, and then if need be, you can make the destructive changes based on that. And that's typically what most of the large internet properties tend to do. What you can also do, especially for smaller workloads or apps, is take advantage of the new Entity Framework migrations feature. That allows you to evolve a database or change the schema, including in destructive ways. And our new ASP.NET templates will run your EF migration as part of app startup. And so if you use the publishing approach that I showed this morning, you can have it when you deploy the new version of the app. The first time it starts up, you can go ahead and automatically change the database as part of EF migrations. And then subsequent requests will handle it. That generally should work fine for most applications. Where it probably wouldn't work as well as if you had hundreds of servers and a very large number of database changes. With a scenario like that, I would probably recommend that first approach of run a script to make the change in a non-destructive way, then update the app code and evolve them separately. But like for my personal website or for most projects I've worked on, you know, even say my blog, which has a lot of traffic, I would probably just use EF migrations. And there might be a couple second period where one of the instances of my app had updated and not the other, but it wouldn't be that big an issue. Other question was around how best to handle app updates without kind of app start pauses. This is one of the nice features that we support with cloud services today, which is the ability to switch between, to enable what we call VIP swaps or virtual IP address swaps. And I think I have a slide deck that shows this. Let me see if I can find it. It might be in here. Let's see. Okay. Yeah, here we go. So there's a couple approaches you can do when you want to update an app. One approach is to do what we call kind of an upgrade domain. And when we do that, we'll take an instance of the machine out of rotation. And then you apply your app update, and then once the code is updated, we add it back into the network rotation. And what you can do as part of your app what's called role startup code, is you can write a little bit of logic that hits the website and doesn't return until the website returns. And the benefit with that is that your machine will not be added into network rotation until the app is warm. And so that provides kind of a simple way that you don't have to worry about that very first request of the machine taking 5 or 6 seconds. You can instead ensure that the app is always active and warm. And then once it's completed, we'll go march and update the next machine down. And so this gives you a nice graceful way that you can apply updates across multiple machines with zero downtime and zero performance impact. The other approach that we support with cloud services is something where if you want to do even more testing or more isolation, you can enable what's called a VIP swap. And a VIP stands for virtual IP address, and it's the public-facing IP address that you map your DNS entry to. And what you can do with Azure is have what's called a production slot for your VIP that's running your current version of your app. And then you can deploy a new update of your app and stand up what's called a staging deployment. And this allows you to put any number of servers you want in it, and we'll expose to you a private URL that you can use to test and access the application. And then when you're ready, you can push a button in the portal, and we will swap the production and staging slots so that all new traffic goes to the new version of the app. And your old version of the app is still available in the staging slot, so that if you need to, you can easily swap it back to the original location. Yeah, so this only changes your compute, and if you're running the cache in a dedicated mode, it can change the cache as well. In the database scenario, you'd want to use that approach that I described of changing the schema and then doing the swap. And making sure it's a non-destructive change. But this ability to do kind of the swap ends up being a pretty powerful feature, and it's a kind of a nice option in the platform. Always on support for SQL. So I was asking about, we are going to support always on using SQL Server running in a VM or infrastructure as a service mode on Azure with the final release of our infrastructure as a service capability. So that is a feature you want to take advantage of. The good news is you'll be able to take advantage of it on top of Azure.
Sure.
Oh, okay.
If I need to, you know, to choose the one path, whether I need to invest in Azure or I need to invest in this standard way.
If you send me email, I can put you in touch with the SQL team. They probably would have the best answer for that. And it probably depends a little bit on your exact workload. So send me an email with more description, and I'll put you in touch, and they can help with a little bit more guidance. Question was, what's the best way to enable apps to self-update? I think there's a couple of frameworks out there. I have not myself used any of them, but typically the pattern that I've seen is to have kind of a watchdog service that's monitoring your app and can download a new version of it, spin it up, and then kill the old version. And I think there are some open source frameworks for .NET that let you do that, but I don't unfortunately know the details or the names of them. But that's probably the suggestion I'd look at. For client apps, you can also use Click Once, which does have an update mechanism built in. So that's another option to look at. Question around how to map U and C shares from the command line. There is...
Well, that was a different question. And if you have time, I could reproduce it by the question. You cannot formulate it in such a way. Exactly.
Map the new disk, and this disk is not available in command line. So
yeah.
That's the question.
Yeah. What I typically do is when I want to use it from the command line, I use net use, and you can either say star or you can give it an explicit drive and then give the share, and then that'll actually work both command line and Explorer. Okay. Or send me email, because I'm not an expert on the shares, but I can try to find someone who is. The other person who might know is Mark Rozinovich, who's doing a Q&A session in 5 minutes. He is more the expert on the internals of Windows, and he would probably be a good person to answer that. Question about best practices for building private clouds. We have a, generally what we'd recommend for building private clouds today would be to use Windows Server 2012, and the new version of System Center that's about to ship that supports it. And we're also coming out with something we call Windows Azure Services for Windows Server. That gives you the same Windows Azure administration tool that I showed earlier, and the website and VM capability running in a private cloud environment on your own data center. And in general, you will see us add more support for private clouds going forward. And our goal is to try to maintain consistency across the two so that you can build apps and maintain code portability between Windows private clouds and Windows Azure public clouds. It's a question about handling Active Directory domain controllers and infrastructure as a service. I don't know the exact best practice, but if you send me email, I can help connect you with someone who does know. Mark Rozinovich also knows a lot more about Active Directory running inside Azure, and so if you go to his talk in a few minutes, that one he can also probably help answer. There was a question about Active Directory Federation Services and Office 365. That is supported today, and so you can set up a federation endpoint for Office 365. You also see us enable a directory sync, including passwords, in the near future. That will avoid the need to set up an ADFS public endpoint as well. Apps versus platforms, how to think about which to prioritize. In general, I think at Microsoft, we think both are important. I think we probably think apps are more important. And certainly we think apps drive the platform. And that is one of the reasons why with the Windows 8 release, we've spent a lot of time both building our own apps that run in it, as well as enabling a store so that you can easily acquire other apps for the platform. And even in the keynote this morning, you know, when Mick was doing his demos, you saw heavy usage of a variety of apps within that context. So I do think we think both are important. Probably historically, we've focused more on the platform. And that's something, you know, with our new releases that we're very much focusing a lot on the apps. For Windows 8 games, for both Windows, for both games and Xbox, you can build the games in a variety of approaches. So some people have used XAML, some people have used HTML. I think the question was around first party or tier one games. We are enabling DirectX support on both Windows 8, on Windows Phone, and on Xbox. And so if you do want maximum portability across those environments and the ability to directly do advanced shader techniques or directly offload as much work to the GPU as possible, you know, probably writing directly to DirectX gives you the most support. In terms of OS strategy for devices, why have three slightly flavored versions of the OS? With the Windows Phone 8, the Windows 8, and the Windows 8 RT releases, we do now share the same core operating system across all our devices, which is a first. And in the case of Windows 8 and Windows 8 RT, they are kind of a pure superset-subset relationship. Everything that runs on Windows RT works with Windows 8. We do think there are slightly flavored versions, so there are differences between them, but that's mostly around form factor and exact use cases. It's not that different than, say, Android or iOS, that also have differences between their phone and tablet versions.
Why do you have a Windows Phone on the tablet?
The question is, why not have Windows Phone on the tablet? You know, in the same way the iPhone and iPad are different, there are similar differences in terms of screen real estate, in terms of phone connectivity and things like that. But our goal is effectively over time, we do see them converging to a much more common base, even more than it is today. But today now, the core operating system, the hardware support, the graphics system, networking, kernel, all of those is now a single code base. The last question here is running scripts from a Windows 8 app and in general, you know, what's supported and not what's not supported when running a Windows Store app in the new user experience. In general, our philosophy has been to try to provide a very secure user experience so that people are never afraid to install apps from the store. And also to provide a very reliable experience so that an app can't cause the system to misbehave inadvertently or cause performance problems. And so generally, in terms of what's allowed and what's not allowed, you know, there's been a principle of first, can it do any harm? And if it can, don't allow that. And I think there's also been a principle, which is if it's not absolutely required, you know, let's not add it in the first release. And kind of going back to the apps versus platforms, we want to drive the platform requirements very much based on the apps that are built, as opposed to open up lots of random APIs and then hope that good apps are built on top of them. And, you know, we'll continue with each release to look at the requirements, and I'm sure we'll add more going forward. But we're trying to be fairly conservative and to make sure that for both a security and performance and reliability perspective, we deliver a really great experience. So, looks like we got through all the questions. Thank you very much. If you have other questions, feel free to send me email or tweets. Thank you and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you very much, Scott.